So first of all, someone we notice when someone says, you know, pro tip, and so we know they're really like in the crew when folks are owning that and they're sharing that stuff. We celebrate it. If it sticks, there's a common practice where somebody says something or shares something that sticks. And there are these odd shaped, large sticky pads in the office. I mean, they're large. They're probably 2 feet across. And that people will write that tip up and put it somewhere that it stood out at. On the virtual side of things and Slack, there's a whole channel dedicated to those kind of tips and things. So, yeah, we definitely lift it up and have it a part of our flow.
Welcome to the Paint and Pipette podcast. My name is Jeremy Utley, and it's my job to illuminate the tactics of world-class performers across domains. As a day job, I teach at the Stanford D School, helping students learn what it takes to come up with ideas. But I've realized I need to stay in the classroom learning myself, and this podcast is my classroom.
Hey, hey, I'm Marcus Hollinger. I lead marketing and creative at Reach Records and Atlanta-based independent record label. And I'm also co-founder for Portrait Coffee, where we are seeking to reimagine the picture that comes to mind for folks in specialty coffee. I'm so excited to pull up my desk alongside my good friend and fellow learner, Jeremy, and I think y'all are going to love what we have for you this season.
We've got some amazing stories on deck, and we can't wait to dive in and learn alongside you.
So grab your pipette and your paintbrush, and let's make something beautiful together.
Today, we talk with Ice Life, the CEO of Life Productives, which is a product development company dedicated to making health and education provocative for hard-to-reach audiences.
He told us an amazing story about how he partnered with the FDA and a local food distributor to bring healthy food to an urban community that he described as being surrounded by biochemical warfare.
He shares many management tips for how to cultivate an environment where people want to show up to work, how to share knowledge, how to celebrate the application of knowledge, and make sure to listen to the end where he lays out his proprietary recipe for learning how to start a business. So Marcus is chief marketing officer at Reach Records, a hip hop label in Atlanta. He's also the founder of Portrait Coffee, which is a black owned coffee roasting. How would you describe, Marcus? I don't even want to put words in your mouth. How would you describe Portrait?
Yeah. So Portrait is a roaster and shop. And our vision is to reimagine the picture that comes to folks' mind when they think of specialty coffee.
Huh. Yes. Cool. Right? It's pretty dope. And anyway, Marcus and I have a mission to get to spotlight stories of Black creators, founders, entrepreneurs, artists. We want there to be a broader set of stories being told and being heard. And so every week, either Marcus or myself invites an amazing creative that we want to learn from and whose stories we want to get out to a broader audience in the world. We don't have a podcast as yet, but hopefully at some point it'll become a podcast. Right now we're just kind of getting our feet under us and kind of getting the cycles down, but we're recording all these conversations. And the hope is that at some point in the near future, we could release them to the world and showcase some amazing people. I don't know, Ice, if you've heard
It sounds really special and I'm glad to be in the mix.
Well, I got to say, Ice, I mean, just to come right off the bat, and Marcus, I don't know how much you know about Ice Life and his work, but I met Ice at the D School. Now it's been basically a month ago. And from the get, he had me at hello with an amazing story about hiring and growing a business and delegation. And I won't spill the beans on that story, Ice, in case you want to drop it later, but they're your beans to spill, not mine. But what I thought would be interesting to hear is, when did the business get beyond your ability to manage yourself? How did you know you needed to start delegating, basically?
Whoa, that's a great question. So I'm chief executive officer of Life Productives. We're a social marketing and product development firm in our 16th year. And and I also started really young. I mean, I have a firm that's 16 years old and I'm 38 years old. So I've been at it a really long time. And for me, first of all, it took me probably 3 years to go, oh, I have a business. You know, like that, that takes a second. You know that you're doing something and you know that it's, you know, you're putting forth this great effort. But I think those of us that have social enterprises, especially, you're really just trying to fill a void. And that's what I was attempting to do out of the gate. And when it started to grow beyond my control, or when I knew it was time to get other people in the set moving on everything from hiring decisions to whether we took on a client, how we managed crises, how we sustained and maximized on really good leaps forward that were not turbulent, it came not so much around bottom line pieces, but more so around the emotional intelligence in our organization, that it was really necessary for us to make sure that we were fostering not the emotional needs of our staff and clients, but the emotional intelligence, and that people's ability to navigate what they're feeling was at the forefront. And that's something that shouldn't be personality based. It should be institutional based. And not only should it be the institutional memory of the company, but everyone, even the leadership, has to subordinate to that process, which as a founder, you know, you really, that's something to navigate, you know? And so that's what, when I would say I started to really see that. And it goes hand in hand with the success of the company. I could parallel when that became necessary with when we started to do really profitable business. I think that it went side by side, which isn't talked about enough, I don't think.
Well, Jeremy, I see why he had you at Hello, and I'm in. So I'm really curious about what I hear you saying is you realized at a stage in your company that it was time to institutionalize emotional intelligence.
Yes.
What am I intuition? I feel I understand that, but I would love to hear you just tell us, what does that mean?
Oh, well, I appreciate the question. Emotional intelligence for me is the ability to, at its core, the ability to have a certain social literacy, the ability to understand the environment around you and yourself in relation to that environment. And so, for example, emotions are the way we talk about it at the firm. And remember, this is not like a super esoterical space. We don't sell crystals, you know, or anything like that. But it's still at the core of our makeup is that arousal plus a label equals an emotion. So if there's something happens. So, for example,
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but can you repeat that? Because that sounds so paradigmatic and so much like, wait, whatever comes next is about to change my life. Can you please repeat that last thing you said?
I don't know. I hope it's helpful, at least, for sure, man. And no problem. That arousal plus a label equals an emotion. So in the business context, the way it comes out day to day in anyone's company, for example, is let's say a client calls and says, what's going on with the timeline of a prototype? So now they may that call might come into me, and then I open the calendar and I go, oh, it'll be there on the 14th. But again, humbly, I've been at it for 15 years. Someone newer in the mix, or even those of us that have been around longer, we can still be guilty of this. That call comes in and the question is internalized and personalized to, I'm not doing my job, or is this person accusing me of not delivering this thing on time? Or so that arousal then turns into the label. So the label is, I feel, let's say, not appreciated. And then the emotion to attach to that is frustration. Now comes how they display the frustration. Is it they, and this isn't personal to anyone at my company, it can happen anywhere. Is it how they start kind of showing up in a gruff? Do they get insecure about their job security? So they start panicking. Maybe they take an interview at another company that they wouldn't have taken if they felt like their position was secure. There's all of this kind of rattling that goes on that normally just kind of breathing and looking at it with a certain lens, and also as a business leader, what we can make a mistake of doing is that, and this is big culturally as well, that if you don't want to come off like fake, if you don't want to come off like every day validating people and telling them they're great and awesome, if you don't innovate around other ways to evoke that same sentiment, then you may accidentally, a few 6 weeks go by and you haven't pointed out in a tangible way something that's great that somebody did. In a tangible way, you haven't lifted up a great solution somebody brought, especially in juxtaposition of how many times as a leader you'll bring up when somebody messed up or you express something that isn't going the way that you'd like it to go. So all of those pieces around how we maintain a loving environment where no one is dreading walking in the door every morning is, I think, a big part of our continued success. And I'm always glad to talk about it and share it.
So Ice, one question I'm curious about is maintaining a loving environment where people are excited to come in. To me, what that kind of triggers is there's only so much you can control, meaning your environment that you set in the workplace is one element. But then, like you said, like the client call saying, what's going on with the timeline of the prototype? I wonder if you could talk about elements that are inside your control, outside of your control, and how you think about that. If you want to create that loving environment, how you accommodate factors that are beyond your control.
It's a great question. So something that how I can frame it is I think about it often like this. So I was born at the end of the 20th century. I became a man at the dawn of the 21st century, and I will die near the end or near the dawn of the 22nd century. And so what in this span, what is the world that I found myself in? And with our staffing and with our company, the question always is, okay, this company is thriving in what era in world history, in environmental history? What are the different spiritual and humanity-based principles that come into the work, whether that's overt or inadvertent? And so when those outside elements, I begin with just a core at the company around we're okay, we're good. And by we're good, I mean, like, everyone is here because we want you here. We want you to stay here, and it's great. And nothing from the outside world is going to come in and make leadership here doubt you. If I get a call from a client and they tell me something wild transpired on a project, it doesn't happen often, I don't take the client's word for it. I come and I ask, well, what happened? What's going on? And making sure our staff knows that that's going to happen. Making sure our staff knows that it's okay to fail. Again, when we have some of these conversations about like race and inclusion, I'm often approached, and, you know, recently was doing this talk at Google, and they're like, you know, what do communities of color need to thrive in business? And I'm like, the same thing you need, access to credit, a loan, don't shoot me on my way to work, and a chance to play in the field. It's like this exotification of the experience. But I think really what folks need, anybody, regardless of their race or background, is you need to feel like that you can err, that you can make a mistake, and it doesn't mean that your opportunity is going to be taken from you. From a Black perspective, and I'm only speaking to this because this is what I understand the framing of your show to be about, is not only are experiences taken from Black people when they make a mistake, we're not even given the opportunity before we can make the mistake. So, which means that there's with people of color, with women, with poor white folks, there is this position of scarcity. And that if I mess up, it's going to be so punitive. And so the first thing about navigating our team being secure is knowing that there's room and margin for error, and that your position or post in the firm socially and technically doesn't change. The other thing, though, is that if there's an outside thing that comes in and you're fallible or we're wrong or there's something we could have done better, you're going to be held accountable to that. But the beauty and accountability, and then when we blame ourselves when something goes wrong, is, well, if I was part of the problem, that means I get the opportunity to be part of the solution. If the outside has all these terrible things that can come in and do damage to reputation and projects. Well, that's really scary. But if we know that if something goes wrong, it's on us just as much as something right is on us, then we're able to push through it. So I think that that's a big part of how we control or how we look at those outside things and not dramatizing them. I think, you know, Jeremy, something that I see often is that there's this a constant dramatize. People use this word crazy all the time. So, for example, somebody will be coming in the office and they get off the elevator and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm late. There were people on the elevator. It's crazy.
there shouldn't be people riding the elevator.
Yeah. Or, man, I'm trying to get some water in this water bottle. It's crazy. And we dramatize every moment. And I think it comes somewhere from a lack of faith, really, in our environment and something, a higher plan for why the world takes the shape that it does. And I think we feel overly responsible for everything going right. And so what I try to infuse at the firm is that, you know, a confidence in our team that nobody or no situation caused by you or an outside factor is an immediate threat to your position and standing at the company. And I think that goes far with it.
I want to ask a question because you talk about environmental awareness and also you talk about this dramatization. And I want to put this in context of where we are right now, because there's a lot going on in our environment. And we've seen and we are seeing a lot of crazy stuff. So maybe take us into the June 6th, 2021, right? We've got this outside stimulus, the Capitol riot. Folks are probably seeing that on the news, showing up to work, feeling a lot of pressure. Sorry, I'm late. You know, crazy stuff going on. How are you guys putting this into practice in real time where we are right now?
Great question. So for us, because our work is so much of it is not so much of it. All of it is tied to social enterprise. Long before the current issues of the day, we've always kind of been operating from a space of addressing like issues and challenges. So we kind of have that blessing of kind of seeing ahead of being not seeing ahead of the curve, but I guess we've been really practicing it. The first thing that we did at the start of the pandemic and then a lot of the social unrest and then even just at the top of the year with this thing is there's a safe space for folks to say they need a minute. And it doesn't have to be tied acutely to some moment. We encourage and we have monthly talks, or be it leadership at the company or we invite someone in. And one thing that we talk about a lot is the being aware of the cognitive map. So social media and a constant, my grandfather, he got the news twice a day. He got the news in the morning, reading the paper, and on the evening news at night. There wasn't this kind of berating of news. And also, let's say his neighbor read some paper that stood out to him. He couldn't run over and just tape it on my grandpa's face, which is what I think it's like in the world of social media, where someone else can have a news story that they're really into and they just throw it in your face. So we talk about the cognitive map, being mindful that the structure of news media right now, that it controls the cognitive map. They can point in a way like never before a billion people to be looking at and focused on and knowing about the same thing, from something as social and irrelevant as the latest dance craze or a crate challenge or whether Britney Spears is getting her accounts back to herself, to something as consequential as a global pandemic. Whether we want to admit it or not, the degree that we talk about or know about these things are often correlated right with the amount of coverage that's getting on the news. And so we try to create a space that, one, we make room for all the things that people care about and what they're being driven to in the day, and we don't police that at all, but also for us to be mindful to not, as developers, because we're product developers, to be mindful of not being overly absorbed in it. And I think that a big scale to me or a way that I was able to measure it was we gave a lot of carte blanche at the beginning of the pandemic for folks to work remote, to come in before the stay-at-home order. And we just sat back, and what we saw is that people wanted to come to work. And I think that, and I know that from some of the blind surveying we did at the company, that is that people feel like it's a safe space where they can choose when to be in the wind of the day and when to be inside. Now, I'm proud of that. I take no credit for it, but I'm proud of it.
That's powerful. And how, just stepping back a little bit, because Jeremy asked a question about controlling what you can control. What are some of the inputs that the leadership team that you're a part of at the company are taking in to be able to continue to curate and cultivate this space?
There's a lot of self-appointed training stuff that our staff has access to where they can, there can be something that they want to go see, that they want to study, a class that they want to take, a course or a training they want. We cover that. Also, if we haven't heard from folks in a while, from people like about them taking a training or a course, it'll come up in their review like, hey, you know, you should take advantage of these resources. What would you like to do? You know, what stuff would you like to explore? We read together. We read texts that come from business leadership spaces. We read those things together, a chapter at a time. And then our staff meeting is weekly, but once every 2 weeks, there's a session where we stay on an extra 30 and discuss whatever chapter we're on. We're still small, you know, it fluctuates between maybe 9 and 16 people on staff. And so we're able to have that type of group thing. And there's a constant value on pro tips and shared learning experiences between us. And I think that's kind of what keeps us there. And I think more than anything.
Ice, do you celebrate that? Like when you say there's a constant value on pro tips, do you call out not just the pro tips, but also the sharing of them, the impact of it? Like how does that value get reinforced?
Oh yeah, big time. So first of all, we notice when someone says, you know, pro tip, and so we know they're really like in the crew, when folks are owning that and they're sharing that stuff, we celebrate it. If it sticks, there's a common practice where somebody says something or shares something that sticks. And there are these odd-shaped, large sticky pads in the office. I mean, they're large. They're probably 2 feet across. And that people will write that tip up and put it somewhere that it stood out at. On the virtual side of things and Slack, there's a whole channel dedicated to those kind of tips and things. So, yeah, we definitely lift it up and have it a part of our flow.
That's cool. I love it. Yeah, I'm always curious about what environmental supports behavior like that is given. So I love the example of, you know, big stickies get put up in the wall, a Slack channel dedicated to pro tips, et cetera. That's, can you tell us what's a recent pro tip that got shared that impacted folks' behavior, attitudes, et cetera?
A big one that came from our innovation strategist was, it looks like a math problem, but it just says acquiring is greater than building. And that really resonated with us. And it was the context that it is that we're developing a kombucha beverage right now. And we also are opening a nursery, a tea nursery. And out the gate, there's all of this, you know, we're building it. And the idea came up, you know what we should do instead? We should go to, well, first of all, this wisdom comes out from leadership staff saying, we should be focusing on acquiring versus building. And was giving all of these reasons why it makes more sense for us to acquire things than to build them from the ground. And one example that, or how it went into practice, is in looking at nurseries. We were looking at all the different land plots in the three different spaces where we're developing these nurseries. Instead, the development team went, and they just looked up nurseries that had like 2-star ratings and said, let's go to them and say, hey, you know, do you want to sell this dump? You know, and because they already have the infrastructure in place, they have the watering systems, they're zoned, they have all of that stuff. And so that was a recent pro tip, acquiring.
Well, wait, hang on. So that, to me, Ice, that's really cool because it isn't exactly what I thought you're going to say. How do you get from, so just walk me through it, you know, real slow, because I'm okay. Slow. How do you get from, okay, I totally track with you that acquiring is better than building. I thought you were going to talk about acquiring customers, you know, getting people to sign up. But tell me how you went from this notion of acquiring is better than building or greater than building, whatever the formula is, to looking up 2-star nurseries. Like, how did that path get traveled? Because that's fascinating.
Cool. Thank you. So it comes up in the conversation, and that in one of these biweekly sessions, this thing around acquiring versus building. and that we were seeing that the start time on when we were looking at what things are accelerating in the work plan and on Gantt charts and what things are delayed were the things that we were just kind of already getting in the mix of that were already developed versus all of the bureaucracy from the ground up. So that's how it came up. There's a thing at the firm that we talk about measurable and tangible outcomes always. And then how do we make sure that we're not just pontificating in meetings about theory or receiving stuff that people are giving us that's really great information and then transmuting it only to pontification. So there's already a culture like that there. So the development team that works right underneath the management team. So we have an executive team at the top, a project management team, and then a development team. The development team is always looking for ways to apply what comes out of those sessions. And so in our agenda for development team meetings at the top of the meetings, there's an image of Bill Nye, the science guy, and it says applied science. And it's a kind of quirky way for us to talk about how are we going to apply anything that came up. The development team, with no project manager or executive manager in the room, said, you know what we should do? Can we get our deputy director to get ICE to sign off on us going and doing bids on low-rated nurseries? And I thought it was brilliant. When it came to me, I think they were expecting like 3 weeks of back and forth. First of all, it was entertaining, but I also thought it was brilliant. And it's working because it turns out there's all of these folks that have these nurseries that they really don't want them anymore. Or they're ran really poorly, but they're up to code because they have to be for the way that the systems are going. So that's how it happened.
Wow. I love it. I mean, the Bill Nye. So you say at the start of every one of these meetings, you've got Bill Nye saying applied knowledge matters. And then what I'm hearing, I'm just reading it back to you and you tell me if that's basically it or not. What I'm hearing is because you've got the executive management, you got project management, you got the development team all in the same meeting, the development team isn't just interested in theory. It's their job to pull something down to ground. And there's almost this kind of like mutual accountability, right? It's the executive team, maybe your project management. I don't know. It's your job to bring the pro tips, bring the inspiration. But then it's the development team's job to say, how do we turn this into action?
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah, it's really cool. That's really cool. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, ICE, I'm super inspired. I'm just thinking about your earlier comments about folks feeling like, hang on, let me look. Nothing, I love you. You said this earlier, nothing's an immediate threat to your standing at the company. How do you distinguish between, you know, a recoverable failure and a performance issue? Meaning, everybody's going to fail and you don't want people to be so afraid to fail that they don't take risks or try new stuff. And at the same time, if someone's, I mean, maybe I'm answering my own question, but if someone's kind of only failing or repeatedly and can't deliver like even basic value at some point, and they're always saying, no, it's safe to fail here. At some point you go, yeah, but like, you know, payroll's about to be in retrograde, to kind of borrow your phrase from another story, right? Yeah. How do you distinguish between the two?
First of all, intent, willingness to correct, like a willingness to course correct. And then as kind of crude as it is this a repeated failure, as you put it? And if that's the case, then we have to make a hard decision. You know, we do our best to preemptively address that hard decision by doing really great hiring and really thinking through that process. And for the person who would be repeatedly making mistakes, the first kind of source of question is to the person who's responsible for training and leading that person. And so it becomes even kind of more daunting for their supervisor than them directly. Our question always is, how are we informing both the heart and mind of the employee? So if I'm only focusing on how much they know, we hire smart people, they're going to know a lot. If I'm only focusing on that, I need to also be focusing on how much they care about what they're learning, how much they really are absorbing their task and their job. And so that's the distinction. And if it's like, well, the issue is either unwillingness or a lack of capacity to put real care and deliberate action into this issue, then, you know, we have to terminate the position or the person in it. And that's never something that we want to do. And on a business level, it's counterproductive to business. You know, if we're paying someone salary, let's say for a year and a half before they lose their job, and we're not able to regain and make good and profit from what the investment is in that position, then it's just a loss across the board. And so we try our best just not to get there. And then the other thing about creating such a love supporting environment is that everyone is woven into each other. And I have on the land at my home, I'm always planting stuff. And it tripped me out when I realized, like, you can cut one stem that is 3 feet away from the other side of this plant. But down in that root, that stem on the left is attached to the one on the far right. And the one on the right dies as soon as you cut that one. In the business ecosphere, it's the same thing. You know, you get people in the room that are building something together and it's real and it's genuine. And then a decision comes up where someone has to go. That impacts the whole company. And we never want that on a human level and on a business level.
Wow. The awareness of that is pretty profound for me. And I want to try to connect that because it seems like where we are right now, we're discussing some of the inner working and the mechanisms of how you guys are accomplishing your mission. And what I understand ICE Life's mission to be is making healthcare and education provocative for hard to reach audiences. I'd love to ask, with the mechanism and that vision, what's maybe one of you guys' your greatest creative accomplishment using the mechanism to accomplish that mission? And for you,
Marcus,
personally,
I'll tell you a really cool story to answer that. That we started developing in like the lifestyle, the health lifestyle space. And what was a cool thing to leverage in those spaces is wherever you go, and I'll keep the names of the companies out of this, but if you go to chain co-op that sells camp gear, you understand, or a healthy bar that you purportedly can eat to climb the mountain better, or active beverage company, all of their branding, all of their messaging is all around environment and inclusion. But when you look at, forget the hiring and the staff, when you look at who they're making their products available to, it was really clear that this industry didn't think that people that didn't look like your typical person in Lululemon pants drinking a latte have no interest in camping and the outside and health. I mean, it's totally negligent and arguably malpractice on a corporate level to be ignoring entire markets. So we went to probably the most popular, most celebrated, and at least known active health bar company out there that is synonymous with, like, if you see somebody eating this, it's like a healthy protein bar choice. And they had approached us before about developing just some regular messaging for them. But I was looking at where they were available in stores. And so, for example, in Los Angeles, there's a certain highway they're not south of. In the Bay Area, there's a certain highway that they're not east of. And the more we were talking, you know, we went in and there's all of these reasons, you know, and they're like, well, we just can't figure out. We don't know. And I'm like, well, that's not the issue. The issue is you don't care about this area. And I'm not saying that as an attack. I'm just saying that for whatever reason, you don't care about that region. But here's the business argument for why you should. And because what I was trying to get, like, I see the average inner city community surrounded by biochemical warfare. McDonald's, KFC, the liquor store, that's chemical warfare marketed on a community. If you can walk out of your house and in walking distance, there's 5 liquor stores that run on permits issued by the city that you live in, that's deep. So instead of griping about that, I was like, well, how do we get a healthier food choice in? So this celebrated, very known, very popular, successful protein health bar company, they explained to us that the issue is that when they put it in the stores, it meets its expiration point and it has to leave the stores. And so we cut a deal to work with a food supplier to come up with an FDA-approved coating that would allow these bars to be on the shelf a little longer, 4 months longer than it had been before, so that a concise marketing and development team could have a chance to really spike that community and get them and get this demographic engaged and buying the product. And so we got the contract to develop that, and then we successfully developed it and then took it to market and then got them a 20% growth margin in that market, which was incredible. But all of it came from first starting with this thing about there's a health disparity that there is across the country. There's areas not that, of course, correlate with race, but also class, that you can't, there's no option outside of technically toxic food. And can we solve that disparity with this company that has all the infrastructure to produce and deliver and ship to this area? We think the market introduced the people to the food. And it worked. That would be an example of something that worked.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge, huge props. And you know what I love is that it takes a systems approach too. You had to be able to work with the FDA, work with the company, have a sense of understanding of a systemic issue. It's not just one thing. Gosh, there's so much more we could cover, Ice. We want to be respectful.
I have so many. I'm good on time for now. I got something coming up in a bit, but I have so many questions for y'all too. So I'm just really great that y'all are doing this. I won't impose my questions on you, but I really think that. Great that y'all are having these conversations. And I still got a bit, but I don't want to hold you either. But feel free.
If you maybe we could just wrap with this, because I think it's kind of a cool line of sight into your thinking, especially somebody who probably is a purveyor of knowledge, you know, among your team. If you could recommend two or three resources for folks who want to enhance their creative practice, grow in their ability to see opportunities, come up with ideas, create value in the world, what are two or three resources you'd recommend as far as somebody wants to push their learning to the next level?
Like reading resources, you're saying?
Could be reading, could be podcasts, could be food, could be, you know, movies, could be, you name it.
Sneakers.
Cool. So a book that I would recommend. Two books and then one podcast. And the books might be a bit of a cliche, but I think they're important. So one, there's a book Miguel Ruiz wrote called The Four Agreements. It's a very well-known book, of course. It's these four agreements that a person makes with themselves. And I would suggest that anyone interested in business pick up this book, even though it's not a business text, because it deals with not taking things personally, being impeccable with your word, not making assumptions, and always doing your best. I think that it's a good thing that has a business mind. The podcast, and I'm switching up because I want to say podcast because there's an exercise I want to encourage anyone that is listening to this to do if they want to start a business. The podcast, I really enjoy the Business Wars podcast. And what I like about the Business Wars podcast, one of my favorite podcasts, is it will, for example, when I think of Nintendo, I think about, okay, if you ask me when was Nintendo founded, I'd go, oh, Nintendo was founded in 1981. Nintendo was founded in the late 1800s. The dude that founded Nintendo, the grandfather of the dude who would create the video games that we all know and love, he had a card playing company. You know, and they, you know, so they'll do like Nintendo versus Sony, or Harley Davidson versus Yamaha, or one of my favorite ones was the WWF versus the WCW. And it has these, with these really dramatic kind of stories from products and things that we've known all our lives that kind of give a great kind of background story that I think anyone going into business can appreciate. The exercise is,
that's cool.
I live in a time where everyone is like talking about starting a business and having their own thing. And they talk about it in this really kind of light way, you know. And I think that I encourage you, one, if you want to start a business, first thing I say is pick something that you really, really love to do and don't do it for 30 days. And go fishing, you know, like go fishing alone, catch a fish, clean the fish and eat the fish. And then the last part of it that I think is an interesting part of the exercise is to, for every day, do something that's built in that 30-day span that's building towards what you want to do. And this concoction of things without revealing what comes out at the end, it really is a great kind of set-in to the rest of what you're doing. And it makes very real what the experience of starting and running your own business is like.
So just
that would be my
offer. Just to be sure, I understand the instruction. It's three parts. One is find something that you love and don't do it for 30 days. Two is
that's right.
Two is go fishing alone, catch a fish, clean the fish, probably cook the fish, then eat it, unless it's sashimi grade.
And eat it. Yeah.
Eat it. And then three is do something every day that's building towards what you want to do.
Towards your company and your goal. Yep. And I've done it, and I've led many people on the process of doing that. And it's a doozy, but it's a blessing.
I wish you could see Marcus's face right now, because he's going, I see the wheels turning for Marcus.
Yeah, I'm already there. I'm in my mind, I'm on the boat with this fish.
Yeah. You know, the crazy thing about the boat part, Marcus, it's like when you catch the fish in that mind state, it's kind of maybe a little morbid to say, but the patience and the aggression the task takes is deep, man. You know, like nothing. Wow. We go and order some salmon at a restaurant. Right. Somebody caught that fish on a boat and cut its head off. They pushed a worm through a hook and they sat there. And that's
the fishing. So just in turn, I mean, somebody's going to listen to this maybe someday, or maybe Marcus is going to do it, you know, this weekend. Do you start with fishing? Do you, like, is the fishing exercise day one of 30 days? Is it day 30? Does it matter when it takes place in the sequence of not doing something you love and doing something every day? Where does it fall?
The way that we've always done it is at the beginning is just something that you really like doing. And normally, it's interesting, it's normally something connected with food. People choose. You can choose whatever you want, you know, but not doing that for 30 days. And within the span of that 30 days, you go fishing and you stay out there. What it takes to make the time to do that, to actually go and do it. Many people don't even know where to start. So where that you realize, like, I'll give you a cheat hint right here. Most people don't know, Jeremy, they don't go, oh, I need a fishing permit. Like, what it takes to actually get out there.
Yeah.
And be in the mix. And of course, I hope that's helpful and I'm answering your question.
No, you totally are.
This has been great.
This is an incredible conversation. I feel like it's a part one of a multi-part. Maybe we say, let's do part two after Marcus and I undertake the challenge. Cause I feel like
that's it.
Jedi sensei and help us unpack our experiences. That could be pretty fun.
Well, I'm game for it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the time today.